Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, ahead of the International AIDS Conference in Washington, D.C., Catholic groups get together to share best practice in the fight against this pandemic. And faith on the front lines. The Catholic Bishop of the Forces in the UK talks about a vocations crisis for this most challenging ministry. How successful has the Catholic Church been in responding to the AIDS crisis? What do faith groups offer people living with HIV that may not be available from secular sources? And how can the Church maintain its AIDS ministry effectively in the face of funding cutbacks and shortages? Well, all these questions will be on the table at a Catholic AIDS conference being held in Washington, D.C. this weekend, ahead of the UN International AIDS Conference due to open in the U.S. Capitol on Sunday. The UN meeting, which concludes on Friday 27th, has taken as its theme Turning the Tide Together. A staggering 30,000 scientists, activists, researchers, healthcare professionals, celebrities and experts of all kinds will be reviewing progress over the past 2 years and discussing new ways of winning the battle against the global HIV pandemic. Among the participants at both events is Monsignor Robert Vitillo, Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to the Worldwide Caritas Confederation. He spoke with me about his hopes for the UN meeting and the focus of the Catholic Conference, which opens on Friday. You're attending this AIDS 2012 conference in Washington entitled Turning the Tide Together. That theme would suggest a new sense of optimism about overcoming this pandemic. Do you think that's justified?
Well, I think it's justified in the sense that we certainly have very good results with the people who are getting access to antiretroviral treatments. And we also have more and more people in developing countries getting that kind of access. Right now, about half of the people who need the treatment are getting access, which is much better than it was 10 years ago when we really started the push to bring antiretroviral treatment to the developing countries. At the same time, I think this title is a sign of people realizing that we can no longer work on HIV and AIDS in a silo kind of approach. And certainly, we can no longer see it simply as a medical situation. And so I hope that it will bring about a real sense of approaching HIV and AIDS in a teamwork fashion with many professions and also dealing with the social, the economic, and the spiritual issues and the emotional issues related to HIV and AIDS, as well as the medical issues.
Does the conference set itself any real concrete goals, or is it just a chance to share information, best practice, and to keep the spotlight on this disease?
Yes, the conference organizers have set a number of goals, not just for the conference itself, but also for the future direction of Turning the Tide Together. First of all, they say they want to make the prevention revolution real, and then they want to work toward expanding testing and treatment. They'd like to make sure that key populations are receiving appropriate attention and funding, and they link together key populations of children as well as those who are vulnerable to infection because of their sexual behavior or because of their use of drugs, injecting drugs. And then they talk about turning the tide on TB and HIV, and this is one of those areas where in the past, they were treated as two separate diseases, and yet the fact is that most people with AIDS actually die of tuberculosis. And then finally, they talk about the need to achieve a cure for HIV.
You talk about making the prevention revolution real. What do you, or what does the conference understand by that, do you think? And what will be the focus of this part of the program?
Well, I think here, too, finally, it seems that some of the HIV specialists and activists realize that the previous approaches, especially taken in the north, the northern countries, in terms of prevention, have not been sufficient. And basically, those previous strategies have focused on the provision and distribution of condoms. And I think that some of the specialists, at least, realize that we need a much more integrated approach to HIV prevention, dealing with some of the social issues and economic issues that make people vulnerable to engage in behaviors that put them at risk of HIV infection, and also making sure that we have a real outreach to people in terms of helping them to be tested early and then to get access to treatment. And when people do have access to treatment, then they're less likely to spread the infection to even to sexual partners. So I think this is what they mean by the prevention revolution. I personally think that they're still missing the boat on some of this because they're not speaking enough about the need to really promote responsible behavior. And I think that until we begin to do that, that we really will not be succeeding in the prevention field.
You're attending a two-day Catholic pre-conference, aren't you, from Friday to Sunday to talk about the church's approach to AIDS ministry. Tell us a bit about who will be there and what will be your goals at this pre-conference.
Yes, for many years now, we've convened the Catholic pre-conference in conjunction with the International AIDS Conference. And the reason for that is that we think it's very, very important for those people working in the field in Catholic Church-related programs to come together and to be able to reflect on the Church's teaching that's at the root of why we do this work in the field of HIV and AIDS and in many of the healthcare and the social services fields. And also then to support each other, to share our experiences, to talk about our challenges as well as our successes, and then to reflect and pray together as well. The big international conference is overwhelming. You mentioned that this time in Washington, they're expecting some 30,000 people. There are constant seminars and plenary sessions and abstract sessions going on. And so we want to give those who are coming from different parts of the world and working in Catholic Church programs a chance to spend a little time together, support each other, and to make networking connections with each other, because then they could follow up in talking with and communicating with each other after the pre-conference. And we've been very successful in doing this for several years now. We're expecting about 65 people to come to this Catholic pre-conference. We have a very interesting series of plenary sessions as well as workshops that we'll be making available to the participants.
One of the areas you'll be focusing on is the church's response to the Prevention of Mother-to-Child Transmission program. How successful has that been?
Well, this is a goal that was set by UNAIDS and the U.S. government's program of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief. It's been quite successful in those areas where we could encourage pregnant women to be tested for HIV early and then to get them onto treatment if they're found to be infected. It's very successful in reducing the possibility of their spreading the infection to their child still in the womb or while the child is being born or after birth through breastfeeding. So it's been successful, but now UNAIDS has set this very ambitious goal, but I think a realistic goal of being able to eliminate new HIV infection in children by the year 2015. And then the key also is to keep their mothers healthy and alive, because we don't want the situation where we prevent the child from being infected, but then the child loses the mother because of AIDS-related illnesses.
There are still a number of obstacles, though, aren't there, particularly in the rural, isolated areas where women have little access to clinics, where they're unable to access the information they need to be part of these programs?
Yes, definitely. And in fact, the Catholic HIV and AIDS Network just did a study of Catholic organizations that are engaged in the prevention of mother-to-child transmission programs and treatment for both mothers and children. And the respondents told us that the rural areas still have many challenges in trying to achieve these goals that have been set by the UN. And the challenges that they mentioned were lack of appropriate funding. They also talked about not being involved in helping to formulate the national plan. And they have a very unique perspective because they are in the rural areas and the governments need to hear about their experiences and their challenges. And also the fact that it's very hard for people living in rural areas to access healthcare facilities, a lack of transport. Sometimes people have to walk for 2 or 3 days to get to the nearest health facility. And then they get there and they're told, well, we're out of medicines now, and so you have to come back another time. Also, the lack of nutritional supplements. people on HIV treatment need to have additional food and good food, good nutritious food. And while many of the government and international agencies sponsor programs to fund the medicines themselves, not enough of them include nutritional supplement as part of the treatment.
This is also a gender issue, though, isn't it? And I see you're increasingly focusing on including men in trying to push these programs to prevent mother and child transmission.
Yes, another interesting finding from this study that we just did, and we'll be launching the report of the study during the Catholic pre-conference, was that the Catholic programs report taking a whole family approach to HIV treatment and prevention. And I'd say that that's somewhat different from many other programs where there may be a strong focus on women and women empowerment, but they try to take women out of the picture of the family itself. And so through this family focus, a number of Catholic organizations have begun to promote involvement of men even in the prevention of mother-to-child transmission programs. And so Catholic Relief Services and Catholic Medical Mission Board are two agencies that have taken a real leadership in this new model in Africa especially. And then the Catholic HIV and AIDS office in Papua New Guinea has taken a similar approach and has been written up by UNICEF as the best practice in this field. And essentially they try to encourage couples to be tested together so that both husband and wife will find out about their HIV status together and then see this as a family problem, not only of a problem of the man or of the woman. And also together they can acknowledge and follow up on their responsibility to keep the child from being infected and to keep the mothers healthy so that the child will have a mother alive and taking care of that child. One very interesting model that was developed in Africa, in Zambia, and in Kenya was that if a woman comes alone to the antenatal clinic, then she's really encouraged to get her husband to come on the second visit. And she's helped to write a kind of love letter to her husband, explaining to him how important it is to her and to the whole family that he be part of this process. And that has attracted some of the men to come and be much more active in the prevention of mother-to-child transmission programs.
You mentioned earlier the whole question of funding, and there is a real concern, isn't there, that in the current economic climate there may be a lot more cutbacks to what is no longer seen as an emergency in the way it was perhaps a decade or two ago. How much of this is a real concern to you and the programs you're involved in?
This is a very serious concern. Last year, in conjunction with the United Nations high-level meeting on AIDS that was held at UN headquarters in New York, in preparation for that meeting, the Catholic HIV and AIDS Network did a study of the impact of funding cutbacks and flatlining on our Catholic programs. And once again, we had reports from a number of Catholic programs, especially those working in the developing countries, that already they had seen that impact, that funding was less available for treatment programs, or it might be available for the medicines, but not the auxiliary services that are necessary, the social support, economic support, the nutritional support. And also we had some reporting to us that when a whole family was affected by HIV, mother, father, and children, they were told you have to select one member of the family to go on treatment. Well, in most developing countries, and especially in Africa, people don't select one member of the family to benefit from something. And so we already knew that there were families who were then sharing their medications, which meant that they would have much less benefits because they weren't getting the appropriate dosaging.
Finally, this conference is returning to Washington after 25 years. It hasn't been held in the U.S. since 1987. How important or how significant do you think this is, and how important is the American model or American money in the fight against AIDS today?
Well, I think the fact that the conference has returned to the United States is very significant for many people in the United States, and especially for those who have been involved in responding to AIDS in the U.S. and then later throughout the world for the past 30 years. The fact was that the conference was not held for the last 25 years in the U.S. because of the discriminatory policies of the United States government in allowing people living with HIV to get temporary visas to enter the United States, even just for an AIDS conference. A couple of years ago, the U.S. government withdrew those requirements and those restrictions, and so that's why the International AIDS Society and other organizers of this conference have decided that they would accept an invitation to come back to the United States. significant for the U.S. I think in terms of how significant the U.S. response is throughout the world, certainly the PEPFAR program that was started under the Bush administration and is now has been continued in some forms by the Obama administration have helped many, many people in the poorer countries get access to treatments and to testing and to comprehensive prevention programming, including programming that emphasizes responsible behavior. And that's very, very important. It's also been important to faith-based organizations because it's been easier for faith-based organizations to access that PEPFAR funding than it has been for them to access some other government funding from other governments in Europe and elsewhere in the world. And also, it's been easier to access PEPFAR funding than the Global Fund grants for faith-based organizations. So that's been very significant. At the same time, I think there are many, many significant lessons that have been developed in the developing world that could be used very well in the so-called resource-rich world or the northern countries. And I think we need to be much more open to learn from those experiences, those community-based, those family-centered programs that have been developed by many churches in Africa and Asia and Latin America that have not been implemented very well in the northern countries.
My thanks there to Monsignor Robert Vitillo, Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to the Worldwide Caritas Confederation. How to cope with grief and loss of the latest casualties? How to deal with shock and fear in the face of conflict? The role of a military chaplain is a challenging one, providing spiritual care, a sympathetic ear, or simply words of comfort for those serving in situations of combat in countries around the world. Although military chaplains are highly valued and still much in demand, there is now a severe shortage of priests willing to take on this demanding task. That's according to the Catholic Bishop of the Forces in Great Britain, Richard Moth, who recently appealed for prayers for new vocations to the military chaplaincy. As he prepares to mark the Silver Jubilee of the Military Ordinariate in Britain on September the 29th, Bishop Moth talked to me about this unique form of ministry and the many difficulties facing those who share their faith on the front lines. Bishop Richard Moth, welcome to our Vatican Radio studios.
Thank you very much.
You're
good to be with you.
Catholic Bishop for the Forces.
That's right.
Tell us a bit about the job. What does a Bishop for the Forces actually do?
Well, I see my main task really as doing what I can to support the chaplains and through them, largely, the military community. So I spend a lot of time on the road, travelling. Wherever I have a chaplain, be it Royal Air Force, Royal Navy or Army, I try to visit them in all of their postings. They move very often, every 2 years or so. So by visiting them wherever they are, I gradually work my way around the military world. And so I might do confirmations, I might do a more official visit to a military establishment, meet with families, meet with troops, I might go to training establishments. Wherever the British Army or British forces are in the world, it's a bit more difficult with the Navy. I can't always catch up with ships, but certainly wherever our forces are in the world, so I try to go.
There is currently a shortage of military chaplains, isn't there?
There is. We are underborn, as the word the military would probably use for it, in all three services, particularly at the moment in the Royal Air Force. And I have a very real sense that military chaplaincy is a vocation within a vocation. So many people will be called to priesthood, but not so many will be called to military chaplaincy. So a little earlier this year, just a few months ago, we issued a little prayer card praying for vocations to that specific vocation. And so we pray that over time some more priests will come forward and bishops will be able to release them, because in a situation where most dioceses could do with more priests, I fully understand it's not always easy for bishops to let people go. Come to me for a bit.
It also sounds like an incredibly difficult task, a military chaplain, particularly those serving in areas of conflict, if we think, for example, of Afghanistan at the moment.
Yes, it's not at all an easy task. Wherever our forces are, so we want our chaplains to be, we try to make sure that we have chaplains in training establishments, because then as people start their military careers, if they have a good experience of chaplaincy, then they will be open to it later on in their service. And obviously we have chaplains in theatre in Afghanistan, and then with the Royal Navy, particularly the Gulf and the Indian Ocean, sort of piracy operation off the African coast. And I was blessed really to be able to be in Afghanistan for a brief visit in February of this year, and met with the chaplains of all denominations there. And at that stage we had three Catholic chaplains in theatre, so I was able to meet with them in situ in Camp Bastion and spend some time with them.
And what kind of feedback did you get from them in this, as I say, incredibly challenging situation where they're dealing, I imagine, on a daily basis with injured, with perhaps bereaved families back home?
Mm-hmm. Well, the response really is very positive. They're hugely valued by personnel and families. Even if you might have one of the service personnel may not be a person of great faith themselves, they really do recognise the value of the chaplain and the support that they give somebody outside the chain of command to whom they can go with their problems, somebody who will pray with them, will be with them in those difficult moments, and really, I think, bring them a sense of hope. You know, one or two of our chaplains have spoken about the way in which they feel very strongly that they're bringing the hope that comes from the resurrection, ultimately, into these most difficult situations. So it's a hugely valuable ministry, and I often say it's not optional, it's vital.
You talk about it being outside the chain of command, somebody they can talk to. I'm wondering how this ministry is seen by the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, those who are in charge of the chain of command.
Oh, completely on side, yes. And chaplaincy has a very fine history in the forces, in a number of countries, and certainly in the British forces, the role of the chaplain is highly respected. And it's anybody can turn to them, regardless of rank. And interestingly, in the Royal Navy, they have the tradition of the chaplain not wearing rank badges. They do in the other two services. It doesn't make any difference to their approachability, in fact, in my estimations. But yes, anybody can go to the chaplain. That really is valued.
The chaplains are there to support, as you say, anybody in need in those very challenging situations. What about support for the chaplains themselves?
Well, we try to put some things into place within the bishopric of the forces. We meet every year for retreat together, when all the chaplains, apart from those who are on operations, gather together for a week's retreat. Each of the services has a Catholic chaplains conference every year, which I go to for at least part of it. And we've also put in place a number of things to provide spiritual direction for chaplains and all that side of things as well. And so in each service, I have a senior Catholic chaplain. And so we give as much support within the bishopric family, if you like, as we can. And then also within each service, chaplains meet together. They have continuing development in their role as chaplains. So there is quite a lot of support that's provided, and we're blessed in the British military to have a chaplaincy centre in a large house in the country, and chaplains can go there for courses and spend time learning from one another and supporting one another in prayer and in time together.
Do you work very much with other professional services in terms of psychological support?
Where that's necessary, then it's available. And also, coming back from a time on operations, they have a very good amount of post operation leave, which enables them to rest and recoup and build themselves back up again. So if there's a need, we do our best to respond to it, but I would say our chaplains cope very, very well. They're people of robust faith.
Looking at the situation in the UK, just recently the British government and health officials in England were warning of a ticking time bomb of mental illness and suicide among young army veterans who returned from hand-to-hand combat in Afghanistan. Figures quite alarming, showing the number of veterans from previous situations of conflict in Iraq and in the Falklands, very high levels of suicide long after that experience of combat was over.
Yeah.
Do you share these concerns?
I do. I mean, there are a number of things available to veterans who left the services. But of course, sometimes if you're in a particularly bad place psychologically, if your mental health is poor, you're not always going to be so ready to access them. We do have a very wonderful charity in England called Combat Stress that does a huge amount for people. And I think it is fair to say that the military community has learnt a lot and developed quite a bit in recent years. it is the case that sometimes the symptoms, if you like, of serious mental difficulty take a long while to manifest themselves.
Up to 14 years or more,
yes,
according to the professionals.
Yes, that seems to be the received wisdom. So I think there is a responsibility for the wider community to keep an eye, because if you've been gone from the military world for that number of years and you're back in a civilian community, then I really do think there is a need for that community to have an awareness and be ready to support. So it's interesting that in recent years our own Bishops' Conference has set in progress a project on mental health, which, in fact, I've been asked to sort of chair that project on behalf of the Bishops' Conference. And I think it's developed actually rather well, and I think it's going to be a small way in which our community of the Catholic Church in England can grow in our awareness of the needs of mental health and offer something of our own contribution as part of that to the community of military veterans.
Is this again sparked by a concern that it's a growing issue amongst young people particularly?
Well, I think it's wider than that. We have in England, Wales every year, we have a collection in the church, the Day for Life, concerned with issues of life from conception to natural death. And two or three years ago, as part of that collection, the Bishops' Conference set aside a pretty respectable sum of money for this mental health project. So we were able to employ a worker to see the project through. We've got a reference group gathered together to oversee it. And then we financed 11 different projects across the Diocese of England and Wales, looking at a whole raft of areas from, for instance, stress for students preparing for examinations, the needs of the Irish travelling community in prison, mental health for the homeless. And of course, there's an increasing number of ex-military who are homeless at present. There was some material on spirituality for people with mental health issues, something there for Alzheimer's sufferers, a great raft of projects. And then we had a conference in February of this year, bringing those projects together with people from the diocese. And just last week, we had a retreat for mental health chaplains, and we had two psychiatrists, one of them from the military, on that retreat at Douay Abbey in England. So the project is kind of building, and I really hope it's going to be a very positive response from the Catholic Church to the mental health needs of the country. And everybody's living under stress. With the present economic situation, those stresses seem to be growing.
Have you seen evidence of that? Do you see an increase in numbers of cases, do you think, perhaps due to the recession?
I think it's a contributing factor, let me put it that way. I'm probably not quite close enough to the rock face of mental health to have the statistics. But certainly one hears anecdotal evidence of the struggles that people are having.
And increases in suicides, particularly people, small businesses are shutting, unable to find alternative employment.
That's right. And even if it doesn't lead people to suicide, people are living under enormous mental health stresses. And as a community of faith, I think it's part of our response to the gospel to be there to support, and for the churches really to be communities of support and encouragement and nurture for everybody.
There has been a huge increase in awareness around many of these issues, from post-traumatic stress syndrome to many other forms of stress and anxiety and mental health illnesses. Do you think, though, there is still a stigma attached to it?
I would have to say there is. Speaking to a number of mental health professionals, they feel that branch of medicine is seen by some as a bit of a Cinderella. And also, still, there is the stigma, a lack of understanding amongst most people, a bit of fear, sometimes because of people that they may have encountered wandering their streets who they find, you know, a challenge to them. And so, yes, there are issues there. I do think, again, it's a fundamental response, I believe, to the gospel, that we reach out as a community to people suffering all those kinds of stresses, military, community and beyond.
My thanks there to the Catholic Bishop of the Forces in Great Britain, Richard Moth. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.